All right. Welcome and a very warm good afternoon. Hopefully this is the last session of the day for most of you and you have the Tech Expo reception following back at 6:30. So hopefully this will be interesting for you. And I want to keep this fairly interactive. So if you have any questions, you're welcome to go to the mic as well. And then I'm going to slot in around 10 minutes at the end of the presentation. So just a quick introduction. My name is Siddhartha Roy, and I'm the Group Program Manager for Windows Server Storage and High Availability back in Redmond. Although I'm speaking here, I represent a lot of team members across Microsoft in different locations in the world who are kind of collectively pulling together to do a lot of good things in storage across the entire stack, local file system, distributed file system, the scale-out file server, SMB, NFS, iSCSI, I could go on. So I'm their talking head right now. So before I begin, I just wanted to frame the conversation for the next hour or so and talk a little bit about how we think about storage back in Microsoft, right? So when you are hearing about storage today, you have heard the term SDS, software-defined storage, okay? What does that really mean? So in the context of Microsoft, obviously you have heard about the three cloud strategy where basically we have one consistent platform, one consistent engineering practice across our three clouds. That's Microsoft internal cloud, the customer clouds, like enterprise customers who want to have the service provider and public cloud economics. And then there are service providers who are hosting applications for enterprises today. Straddle, that's our generic cloud statement across our different assets, storage, compute, network. If I double-click on storage, let's just walk through the different storage offerings here. So we have our private cloud today with partner storage, right? That could be a SAN, or Fibre Channel SAN, or iSCSI SAN, or even NAS, Unified NAS, which has Fibre Channel, iSCSI, and NFS, and SMB coming back. And that is basically supported with our private cloud strategy. We have a rich partner ecosystem. We continue to support that, and a lot of the room today has SAN and NAS deployed. We wholeheartedly embrace that. That's the first box right here. At the same time, we have heard a lot of customers asking for an all-up Microsoft storage stack, in the sense that when we own the hypervisor, which is the compute, and then you have network, it kind of makes sense to have an all-up story. So we kind of looked and heard at that feedback back in 2009, 2010, and then that's when we started the software-defined storage journey. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then for people who want to extend their private cloud onto Azure, we have the hybrid cloud strategy. And that's a company we acquired back in 2012 called StorSimple, as many of you may know. And StorSimple basically sits in the data center, and it helps extend your on-prem data center to Azure by tiering a lot of the warm and the cold data. And if you see 70% of your data is cold, it kind of tears that off into Azure so that you don't need to, buy more expensive capacity or storage capacity on-prem. You can defer a lot of your capacity purchases later. And then, of course, rounding that out, you have public cloud, which is Azure. So if you look at the breadth of the offerings on private cloud with Microsoft software-defined storage, hybrid cloud, and public cloud, one theme resonates. Across these three stacks, we are doing a lot of the joint end-to-end software-defined storage stack. There's a lot of learnings going on across each other here, and we are uniquely positioned in the sense that if you look at the industry, you will see our friends either have one end of the spectrum but not both. Okay, somebody has a private cloud or somebody has a public cloud. We have the end-to-end with a private cloud to hybrid to public. And what that means for customers is we don't want to rush you in your journey, towards the public cloud. We want to make sure you do it at your own pace and when you're comfortable. Yet we will give you mechanisms to start the journey through the hybrid cloud, strategies. So today's discussion, if I had to talk about all those things, it would probably take, quite a few hours. So I'll double-click and really focus today's session on private cloud with Microsoft software-defined storage. Before I do that, I just want to, we have a lot of interesting topics on Windows Server vNext, but I just want to do a quick poll of the room. How many of you have used storage spaces or scale-out file server already? Okay, a few handful in the room. Okay, so I'm going to do a quick preamble for the sake of the rest of the audience, just to kind of recap quickly what we have today in Windows Server 2012 R2. Take like 10 to 15 minutes, and then I'm going to go right into Windows Server vNext, okay? So when we started this journey on software-defined storage back in 2009-2010 timeframe, what were the motivators for us, okay? Essentially, it kind of boiled down to three things. Customers were telling us about, hey, we need software-defined storage. We were seeing the industry trends, and then we were seeing a lot of learnings from our public cloud, like Bing, Office 365, and Azure, okay? So we kind of took all of these three inputs and listening systems and kind of double-clicked on each of them and really designed something that was going to be useful for customers and not something we kind of thought about organically inside and then put out to customers. It was really customer-driven. So I'm going to double-click on some of the things on terms of industry trends. As you know, one of the key trends we have is cloud services influencing design. If you see Azure, a lot of Azure's storage is really built on standard volume hardware in a scale-out paradigm. And what's happening is a lot of the smarts is moving into software. Okay, so the software architectures assume that your hardware world around you is not reliable. So you're really putting a lot of smarts in terms of scale, power, reliability, and resiliency in the software. And there's a lot of learnings we took from Azure, okay? Things like how to rebuild when drives go down at large scale with erasure coding, as an example, okay? So there was a lot of learnings we took back from Azure, and that really influenced the private cloud strategy as well. Data explosion. I don't need to tell you. I mean, we have, as you are seeing, probably are running out of space. It's really driven by client devices proliferation, you know, modern apps, and also essentially unstructured and structured data analytics, which needs large and lots of data. Virtualization was another big factor. Virtualization here is a key part of the private cloud. If you see Azure, that's a virtualized environment. If you see a lot of the private cloud environments our service providers and enterprise customers have, that's also virtualized. And virtualization needs essentially mobility and, you know, a lot of flexibility, a lot of just-in-time provisioning, if you will, and a lot of density. I mean, hosters are in a segment where they want to deliver more to their customers, more VM density, okay, more value per VM, okay? So we listen to that. And then scale out with minimal complex operational complexity. So when you think about private cloud or public cloud, the world is largely scale out. It's going to be a lot of symmetric volume hardware deployed in a scale out model. But typically when folks do scale out, we lose the operational simplicity, okay? So scale out and operational simplicity are typically oxymorons. They don't go hand in hand. So we really want to make sure when we scale out, we don't lose the management simplicity, okay? So it is really fluid in terms of setting up, in terms of adding and deleting nodes, and really fluid and easy to do. So those were the principles in the industry inflection trends. And what about software-defined storage? You will hear a lot of definitions in the industry, and I think really the industry is trying to figure out what it means. So within Microsoft, we can whittle it down to really cloud-scale storage and cost economics on standard volume hardware, okay? We are doing a lot of this. You know, we are taking a lot of learnings of Azure in terms of cost and scale, scale in capacity, perf, availability. One of the things on the volume hardware side, I mean, if you don't know, we are participating in the Open Compute project. Okay, Open Compute is something Facebook started along with Yahoo and a few others, and we also join, and we are contributing server hardware designs, okay, for storage and compute back to the community, okay, where we are saying, hey, this is the footprint of the chassis design, the network, the storage and the compute blades, and this is what we're giving back into the community, okay. And there's an OCP Paris coming up for those of you who are in Paris, I mean, pretty soon. So we are really serious about hardware as well. I want to make sure we pass on the learnings from Azure to our customers. What did customers tell us? I mean, very simply, I'm not going to dwell on this slide too long. Customers wanted efficiency, low cost, flexibility, and automation. Essentially, give me Azure in a box. We took the first step in the journey with the cloud platform system. Some of you who attended Vijay's session previously saw that, where we really delivered a lot of software-defined X, compute network storage and management, all up packaged in a box in a solution. So customers wanted, give me private cloud, give me the economics of, you know, Azure in private clouds. And then the last was the learnings, as I said, from the public cloud. It is not known, not widely known at least, that a lot of our properties run on Windows Server. Okay, if you look at Windows Azure, if you look at Bing, if you look at Xbox One, and a lot of your favorite games on Xbox One, essentially if you're connecting into the backend, that's all hosted on Windows Server. So this is a good thing for us in the sense that, you know, when we are developing Windows Server and releasing in a fast cadence, we also make sure that our internal cloud properties are also our biggest customers. So if you look at our customers, we really have two classic cases of customers. Our big online properties, you know, like Bing, Azure, Office 365, we have to make sure everything we deliver to them is solid, and we also have our external customers like yourselves. So between the two, I think it's a good trade-off and early vetting of the complete storage stack. So it would be remiss of me to not talk about compute and network and show you the bigger picture, okay? So storage is one piece of the puzzle. So if you look at the complete software-defined data center, the complete paradigm, we work very closely with software-defined network and software-defined compute. Since I'm in the HA team as well, I contribute clustering across all three, for example. And really, they have a consistent management paradigm. They have a consistent way of managing elements, like in terms of the chassis management, if you will, in terms of network element management, in terms of storage management, in terms of how they manage hardware, and how they interact with the upper layers, like Windows Azure Pack, for example, and System Center. So we are really making sure we have, you know, horizontal and vertical integration so that we are really telling a holistic story and not like siloed in network storage compute. So where are we in the SDS journey today? For a lot of you who haven't deployed Windows Server 2012 R2, I really just want to kind of quickly ground the audience on what we delivered in 2012, which was in the year 2012, and then R2, which was a year later in 2013. So if you look at the picture here, typically for your Hyper-V cluster, if you look back in 2008 and 2008 R2 days, your Hyper-V cluster was backed by a SAN. Great, great story. Your SAN is a fiber channel, or iSCSI SAN. I think we didn't have a story over file at that time. So folks came to us and said, hey, we need a story around, you know, file. So we kind of started thinking about what the story would be. And we had SMB as a protocol. SMB is developed in my team. So SMB is a protocol which is used for client-to-server communication. People told us we'll be crazy to use SMB for a server-to-storage communication, okay? Because SMB is not meant for, you know, at the time was not meant for, you know, highly performant, available, resilient storage fabric for application data. So we looked hard at that, and really our story is being able to store primary application data on SMB3 file shares, okay? It presents a familiar share paradigm to Windows IT pros. It is not a Loon paradigm. It basically has all the familiarity of the features, and it is backed, that share is highly available, highly performant, and highly reliable, okay? So the Hyper-V cluster in this case is talking to, through a very high-speed network called SMB3 storage fabric, okay? By the way, we are not the only ones who implement SMB3. We have our partners like who in the community who also implement SMB3, like Network Appliance and EMC. So SMB is a protocol. SMB3, the file storage network, and you saw some of the demos probably early today morning, this uses things like SMB Direct for low latency, where you're really bypassing the TCP/IP stack and really get, you know, for your latency-sensitive workloads, it's really giving you very high throughput and what we call low cycles per byte, okay? Think about 2 million IOPS, okay? That's not trivial. 8K, 2 million IOPS is a big, big thing. And also it offers things like multi-channel, okay, where you have multiple paths between, you know, your compute and storage clusters. Now, that SMB storage network, Hyper-V cluster is talking through that SMB storage network to a scale-out file server. And you can keep adding scale-out file servers as you need more bandwidth, more capacity, more performance, okay? And that scale-out file server is backed by storage spaces, essentially, you know. What does that mean today with 2012 R2? We have the back end of these file servers connected through a SAS fabric to to what we call shared JBOD, just a bunch of drives. And those drives could be hard drives or SSDs, and they are tiered together, and they really present a large pool of storage. And the pool of storage is really available, highly resilient. You can carve out different types of what we call storage spaces that are mirrored or parity. I'm not going to go a whole lot into that today. We have a bunch of sessions later in the week. I'll point you to those which go into in-depth details on each of these topics. So with that, let me just give you a quick, that was the physical view. Let me give you a quick view of how the stack looked like when we started doing this journey. So when we looked at this, first at the very bottom, you know, our job was to really give a flexible, elastic, and efficient pool of storage, okay, carved out from standard hard drives and standard SSDs, okay? And that pool of storage is basically built on storage spaces. And it is highly optimized because of two things. It has tiering, and it has deduplication, okay? And that also has the file system. It could be NTFS, or it could be ReFS, which is the new file system introduced back in 2012, which has a lot of integrity and latent bit rot corruption detection capability into the file system. And once you have that, that local storage can be exposed to a remote application. Could be Hyper-V, could be your laptop, or could be Unix clients through multi-protocol data access. So we have iSCSI's target built into Windows Server. If you didn't know that, if you have to have your favorite application use iSCSI, we could do that. We have NFS 3 and NFS 4.1 starting in 2012 for Unix and Linux clients, and also for VMware storage. So if you think about VMware, their VMware VMDKs can be stored on an NFS share. You could use this protocol here. And then you have SMB3 for Windows clients as well. But this is all for, you know, Unix clients and Windows clients and pretty much for VMware. Then we really have a story for what we call first-party workloads, where we have, I talked about that previously, where you're really saying, you know, for all your Microsoft first-party workloads, SharePoint, Exchange, you know, your Hyper-V workload, SQL Server, use basically in a virtualized fashion, store that data on SMB. And this is our North Star in terms of the architecture, okay? What you saw in CPS uses this architecture, okay? This is what we are going to be proving and vetting in Microsoft going forward. So that's our platform. And on top of that, we have a rich story around management with System Center, okay? So we have a pretty strong portfolio of management with System Center. We have a couple of great System Center sessions you guys can go and take a look at. So how real is this? I mean, all I can tell you, I mean, this is, customers are deploying this today. I don't know if you have Philip in the room from NTTX. Philip has been one of our, you know, he's been deploying Windows Server 2012 and R2. Production for his, you know, for his company. He operates out of the UK, and they are primarily VDI, and they use the end-to-end storage stack that I described. This is one of the examples. We have other examples like ClearPoint and a bunch of other customers. And now with CPS, you also get the proof point of, you know, this going to large scale to support, you know, 1 petabyte of storage across 4 of these racks. Okay, 282 terabytes per rack. So this is real. I mean, I would say, you know, give it a try, go out, take a look at this. This is going to be really, you know, revealing in terms of the savings of costs and benefits it can bring you, okay? I know storage is a big percentage of the overall solution cost. This will help you save some of that cost and really divert it to other parts of your IT budget. Okay, with that, let me come, what's new in Windows Server Technical Preview? Very quickly, I just want to walk you through some scenarios, and we'll keep this interactive. When we looked at Windows Server vNext, our journey continues, okay? We kept looking at how can we deliver greater efficiency, more uptime, keep lowering cost. We already lowered cost a lot with spaces and JBODs, but how do we keep lowering costs? How do we have reliability at large scale? And the biggest of this all, how do we have faster time to value? I mean, given the cadence we are on, every shipping every 1 year, for example, in the last 2 releases, we have to be making sure that you, our customers, really are able to adopt our technology as quickly as possible. So with that, I'm going to walk you through some of the scenarios, okay? So first thing I want to talk about, we announced this today in the foundation session, This also came out in the Windows Server technical preview, storage quality of service. Let me tell you the story of why is this even interesting, okay? So when we talked to hosters, our service providers, two things popped up. One of the feedback we heard is, and this is true with anybody right now in the industry, if I have a rogue VM or a VM that is eating up IOPS in my data center, I, as a hoster, there is no way for me to control that today. So you could have a couple of VMs, and you don't know what's running inside those VMs, because typically if it's an unmanaged environment, where they are just kind of where the hoster is just hosting the infrastructure, that could be eating away a lot, and there's no way to throttle those IOPS. That was one. And the second thing we heard is, you know, I, as a customer, need to offer different qualities of service, okay? My bronze SLA, my silver SLA, and my gold SLA. We kind of took that to heart and, okay, let's kind of look at this. This is a very hard problem to solve. This was done internally in cooperation with something between our Hyper-V teams, the file server team, and Microsoft Research. It came out of a, there's a lot of context here. When we looked at this, the scenario is about how do you control and monitor storage performance end-to-end, okay? This is not just on one end of the spectrum on the host or the storage. This is really across the Hyper-V cluster and also the scale-out file server cluster. Let me just tell you what it is. It is enabled by default on the scale-out file server. The metrics that we use for measurement is really two metrics, latency and IOPS. And the one thing I really want to call out is the flexibility on the policy. You can define policies around IOPS by having minimums and maximums, okay? You can really define mins and maxes, and that policy could be very flexible. You could do it at a VHD level, which is your lowest tier, if you will. You could say your SQL log VHD, that needs to have a certain number of IOPS. Or you could do it at the VM level, which is a bunch of VHDs, or you could do it as a service or tenant level. So it's like a pyramid. You could keep adding and doing different levels of service. So it's really flexible. And the algorithms make sure we are doing a very fair distribution of policy, okay? And we're enforcing the policy in that limits, okay? From a management story, it's basically, you know, managed by System Center. And of course, it has PowerShell built in terms of management. One of the things I want to call out is it gives you the end-to-end view between the Hyper-V cluster and the scale-out file server. So it gives you aggregated view at any point of time, and we're going to see it in the demo, in terms of what is available across the data center, basically, and your out-of-band policy manager is really enforcing the traffic and shaping the traffic in the data center. So with that, I'm going to call over Patrick Lang. Patrick is the PM for the storage CoAS scenario. And he's going to basically walk us through the demo. Patrick?
All right. Thank you. Number six. All right, and we're live. All right, so first off, I want to show a couple of the components that are actually used in storage quality of service. I did a really short demo this morning. I want to give a little more context here. So what I have first off is a file server cluster that currently has three nodes, and I already have the scale-out file server role running on this. And that file server cluster is giving me a regular SMB file share that we can see down here, just happens to be called one. And I currently have five VMs up and running on one of my Hyper-V servers. That's what I'm actually connected to right now, but we can see the various VMs running. And just to give you some more detail on the workload, one of these is running a developer desktop workload, and the other one happens to be running a online transaction processing benchmark that's currently consuming, it looks like 8 to 10,000 IOPS. And I've got performance monitor up and running just so I can keep an eye on what's going there. So now that all that's running, I'm actually going to use PowerShell remoting to start asking my file server how things are going. I could log into the file server and run this, or I could just run it all remotely like I'm doing now. So when I query the file server, I can easily see all of the virtual machines that are running, the host that they're running on. If I have policies defined, I can see what the parameters are here. And then I can see the last 5 minutes of performance in normalized IOPS. This is the same unit that will be used to actually define policies in just a moment. And then, of course, I could see the file name for each one. So the first thing I'm going to do is create a policy that to encompass these build workloads. I see that currently they're averaging between 1 and 200. I want to preserve that performance, so I'm going to go ahead and set a minimum, but a max of 200. That way they run within a nice predictable range. So I'm going to create and apply that. And while that's applying, we see that VMs keep running, my storage is still running as expected. And then I can go ahead and monitor against that new performance right here using the same interface. So we can see that's been applied, and then these averages, because they're running slightly faster, will fall into the range shortly. And then I want to go ahead and bring in that big OLTP workload. I want to do this to create more capacity for the VMs I'm going to be starting next. So this next policy that I'm creating and applying is actually quite a bit bigger. I'm giving it a minimum of 3,000 and a max of 5,000. And now that that's already applied, I can go ahead and see how it's performing, and it's now within that range of 3 to 5. So the next thing I want to point out is I've got more servers in my environment, and I'm going to go ahead and start some more VMs on those. So these VMs are not even clustered. They're not communicating, or these Hyper-V hosts are not communicating between them in any way. The only point that we have in common is the file server cluster. So I'm starting up the last VM. So those are all started, but we can see that nothing has impacted the performance of these VMs. They're still running within the defined range. And then, of course, I can go ahead and query the file server again, and I can immediately see the performance of all of those VMs. And I happen to have a rogue VM that's taken 2,500 IOPS. That's a pretty substantial workload, but I still have the bandwidth that's needed for both my high-performance workload as well as for my desktop workloads down here. So I can continue to refine my policies and bring more load without ever losing the performance guarantees. So thank you.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
In the room, I'm wondering, why is the workload still showing 6,000 IOPS? Is it because it needs time to settle down?
Yeah, we show you the last 5 minutes of performance. That way you're not looking at just a single point in time. When you're making policy decisions, it's very important to look at the average workload. If you look at something like that desktop VM, they'll frequently go anywhere from 0 to maybe 1,000 IOPS if I let them. So instead, it's better to look at that window and then determine the right policy. I'll be going into more details on that in my session tomorrow morning.
Patrick, you have a session tomorrow morning at 8:30?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Yep. Okay. All right. So with that, let me just move to the next scenario, rolling upgrades. This is about fast time to value. I mean, this was something when you talk to customers, I mean, the response was, okay, it's about time you guys did this. So this is not new and shiny. It's something, you know, you use every day. This is essentially about, you know, if you have your 2012 R2 cluster, you can upgrade that entire cluster to the vNext cluster without taking down any of your workloads. And we are doing that by really all the orchestration is under the covers. And the key to this is being able to operate in what we call a mixed mode window. So the benefits basically is you're able to upgrade. And when I say upgrade, you're able to install OSs in your down machine. I'm going to talk a little bit about how this works. And really, you know, upgrade your entire cluster in place. Okay, and earlier this used to be pretty painful. You would need to do a complete business practice assessment and plan that out. And by virtue of that, you would ask us, okay, you're delivering great value, but, you know,
I don't know what is the fastest way to get to your OS without taking down all of my service. So how this works is we have an operational mode called mixed mode clusters. So when you start with a, let's say, an 8-node cluster with 2012 R2 nodes, and when you start this process, you can select which node to kind of first start to drain. So it picks that node, it moves all the workloads, you know, into other systems, right, the other nodes. It's able to drain those workloads, and then you basically, it brings that load, node down. You're able to basically either patch it or install the fresh OS. Once you bring that back up, it distributes the loads back, and then it keeps doing it in the cyclical fashion. Now, in this window, you might ask is, how long can I do this? I mean, we don't recommend staying in this mixed mode window of, you know, your 2012 R2 nodes and your vNext nodes for eternity. I mean, don't stay on that window for like 6 months and do your operational, because a lot of things are not working. I mean, we don't recommend staying in that extended window for, you know, we have some downsides of, you know, certain things in terms of backups and, you know, need to be tweaked in the window. So I'm not going to advise you to stay in that window, but it's not like it's good, things are going to break. So once you have done all your transitions, you might think, okay, you install this latest patch driver, okay, and that doesn't work in, you know, vNext, and I want to roll back. You can do that as well. You can roll things back. And once you do that, there's a big red switch, okay? I mean, I don't have the demo today. Once you throw that switch, everything goes to the next, what we call the cluster functional level, okay? In this case, vNext. So it kind of takes you through, it gives you time to go back to the older OSs and kind of go next. So you have a lot of control, yet it's very agile. You know, this is out again in technical preview. We urge you to take a look and try this out in your IT environments. So I want to talk a little bit about Cloud Witness. This was a small feature that we did. It had a lot of benefits. I mean, if you have used clusters, you know that we need a third site for quorum or somebody who should act as the witness. And typically, that third site is another file share in a third data center. Because obviously, I mean, if your main two data centers go down or something goes down, you don't want the witness to be in one of those two data centers, right? So it's pretty expensive in terms of, you know, having to provision a third data center. So this was about how do you make sure that your witness is in Azure. And it's very simple to do. It's very easy to set up. And it basically lets you run your, you know, let's say your stretch cluster scenario where you have two clusters, you know, across sites, and you need a cloud witness in Azure. So you could have that witness in Azure now, right now. I mean, instead of having a dedicated site. You could do a lot of other scenarios. I'm not going to get into clusters without shared storage. And it's really beneficial and helps you save capacity and space. So that was one of the things we did. Again, this is also operational in Windows Server Technical Preview. VM compute resiliency. So let me talk a little bit about that. Remember, I told you building a lot of smarts in software, right? So this is about, we heard a lot of customers, sometimes if they have a flaky switch, a switch which has not gone down completely, or a NIC that is partially bad, it is not zero or one, it's kind of, you know, sometimes going in and out. Clustering has some rigid policies today. It would fail things over, okay? So we want to make sure that we are really not aggressive in our policies, okay? So what this is really when you have outages and glitches that are transient in nature, temporary, okay? You could have a glitch on a switch for like, let's say, 30 seconds and things come back up. So what we're trying to do there is basically we are making sure if there is a transient glitch, basically the VMs, we take that node out of service, okay? And the VMs continue to run, basically. Okay, the VMs continue to run even when the node is isolated. So if there's a VM on a particular node and that node is having some transient issues, we are really, what we are doing is, instead of kicking that out of the cluster and kind of, you know, taking down that node and taking down the entire cluster, we are being a little bit more thoughtful about it. We are saying, hey, for that node, let's not take that out right now. Let's kind of make sure the VMs are running. The VMs are running in non-HA mode. It's without HA. But we kind of let that run for some time and then let the problem rectify itself and then kind of go back and see, okay, then we can bring the VM back into the cluster membership. So what this really means is for a lot of these transient glitches, it really helps you save a lot of, you know, pain today that you have sometimes with the rigid and hard policies.
We'll be happy to chat later about this. The other thing that we did was quarantine of flapping nodes. So this was basically, if you're seeing a node, let's say, which has a bad HBA or a bad NIC, basically, and if it's constantly leaving the cluster, in the previous scenario, you saw that if the node leaves the cluster, we still run the VMs. In this case, what's happening is, if we see the nodes leaving the cluster 3 times an hour, I think our assumption is that that failure is a pretty hard failure. It is not transient. It is something which is systemic in hardware. It is going to happen again and again. So basically, we take that node out of the cluster, and we are able to quarantine it, okay? And then the default cluster property for the quarantine node is 2 hours. Okay, so we give the admin time to kind of go back and see. You can bring that node down, or if the node again has some bad driver which all got installed and needs to be uninstalled back, we give that 2 hours, and then the cluster joins back. Okay, so this was also basically interesting, you know, thought process that we did with this feature and the previous one on how do we basically really deal with transient failures and permanent failures on unreliable hardware componentry. And you will see a lot more of these coming through, okay? With that, let me switch gears to the other scenario that you heard in the keynote today, in Jason Zander's keynote today morning. We talked about storage replica. And before I talk a little bit about the scenario, let me talk about the motivations of why is this interesting. So we heard from a lot of customers who have multiple sites and typically have replication software today, and that can be at different levels. It can be at the SAN array replication level, or it could be in the network replication level, like EMC has Recover Point, for example, or it could be at the host, right? A lot of customers said that I need a single point of support. I need something in the operating system from you guys, something that basically is synchronous mode, and something that really works with my existing storage today. I don't need something fancy that you guys are doing which causes me to throw out my existing storage. I can't do that. I mean, I bought the SANs today. I need this to work on anything. So we kind of took that to heart and started building this out, you know. And this is something we started building out quite a few years ago. And we kind of matured this, hopefully, to the point where we'll have a great version one product. This is essentially enabling you, the scenario here which I'm going to show you, is really enabling a stretch cluster across sites. So in this scenario, you have two sites. Basically, you have site one and site two, each with two nodes. And these two nodes on each side, the total four nodes is part of the same cluster. It's essentially a stretch cluster between sites. And storage replica is replicating the storage between these two sites. Okay. The properties is, in this case, today you use the stretch cluster scenario. Your configuration mechanism is going to be, you know, failover cluster manager UI. Jeff Woolsey showed that today, and you'll see more here. And also with PowerShell. It provides you an end-to-end disaster recovery with all the bits in Windows Server inside the box. Okay? You don't need to buy any other software outside of Windows Server. As I said, it works with any Windows volumes, okay? Interestingly, it uses SMB3 as a transport. So remember, SMB3 as a transport was a transport for server to storage. In this case, it's also a transport for storage to storage. And what it lets us do is, because SMB3 has features like RDMA, you could have RDMA between the sites with your Metro RDMA, for example, from certain vendors like Mellanox, who are starting to do this, who can really go, you can go low latency across metros and across the river. And it also lets you use things like SMB encryption, where you want to encrypt your data in flight, for example. So using SMB3 as a transport has a lot of benefits, where you have the performance of SMB3, have the security of SMB3 for data in flight encryption. You could do a bunch of things like that. Now, this is essentially block level synchronous. We have two modes. We're going to talk a little bit about that, synchronous and asynchronous modes. The synchronous mode, all we ask you is, this works with your existing DWDM, you know, your dark fiber equipment or your IP equipment, whatever you have. The latency, round trip latency, should be less than 5 milliseconds. Okay, if you're able to deliver that, and which most of you can, then we make sure that you can have synchronous operational mode. And then we have the asynchronous mode, which doesn't have stringent, you know, multi-site requirements. Okay,
With that, I'm just going to show a little bit under the covers, and Ned's the PM on this, and he's going to do a Ned demo, and Ned and I are going to be here after the, if you have any detailed questions. So let's just quickly talk about the sync and async modes. How are they fundamentally different? So in the sync mode, what you're seeing is essentially when an application is doing a write, it is writing to the local, every site has a data disk and a log disk, okay? Typically your log disk is an SSD disk, typically something we recommend as a high-speed disk. When you're doing a write, it is first writing to the local disk, and it is going over the wire, essentially to your second site, and here in where it says 3, it is writing also to the remote log disk, okay? Only after that is it acknowledging back to the application. So we really, really make sure that, there is zero data loss and the data is indeed written to the remote site, okay? Asynchronous mode isn't doing that. Asynchronous mode, what it's doing is basically once it writes to the primary copy, it returns back and acts the app. And that's the typical norm in the industry, right? And then it lazily, asynchronously copies the data over to the secondary site. So with that, I'm going to basically switch gears and have Ned do us a great demo. This is going to be the longer version, of the demo. And by the way, Ned also has a session tomorrow.
Yes.
At 5 o'clock. And you're going to have a great session there. You're going to see a lot more of Story Replica. So definitely ask you to see that.
You all hear me okay? Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the first day of TechEd. My name is Ned Pyle. I'm the program manager of Story Replica. And if you went to the keynote this morning, you saw Jeff Woolsey go and do a great quick demo of just provisioning replication in storage replica in a stretch cluster. And I'm going to do the same, but I'm going to go a little bit further and show you some of the operational details. And then if you want to see server to server or things like cluster to cluster or using PowerShell or all the other pieces that don't get shown, plus my enormous wit and good luck with that, 5 o'clock tomorrow, 5 o'clock. Just remember 5 o'clock, Wednesday, me. Look for me. So, let's see if this will be blessed by the demo gods. So I have here a single file server role clustered. And I have storage, 4 nodes. This is all running on my laptop, so this will not be the fastest demo you've ever seen. But it does prove that it works. And I have storage attached to these asymmetric storage. So if you're not familiar with clustering, Windows clustering, this is the mode where half of the storage is visible by half of the nodes and the other half by the other. Basically, I'm taking my storage and either zoning it or placing the actual shared storage in the two physical sites, which is the recommendation. And this is all running, in this particular case, I'm using iSCSI. But you could use JBODs, just a bunch of disks, SAS. You could use your SAN. As long as you can cluster it, you can replicate it. I don't know or care what you paid for or who you bought your storage from. It's not interesting to me at all. All I care about is that you're running Windows, and I'll replicate your volumes. So if you see here, you can see that I have all this lovely iSCSI storage here. And you can even see, if you look carefully, and I do have Zoom it on here, I think, if you can't see, let's pop out a little bit, that these are connected, split between two sets of servers. You can see server 1 and server 3 and server 4 and server 2. So there's no smoke and mirrors. This is really happening on my laptop right now. So all I have to do to configure replication, this is the really easy part, is enable replication. And I get a nice wizard. Now, you can do all this right now with technical preview. All of this. I'm running technical preview. Many of these things have changed since we gave you technical preview. So definitely don't look at some of the strings and the appearance of the order and say, I want this done differently, because we probably already took care of your request. So what I'm doing, you saw I picked a source disk. I started with what I want to replicate from. I'm going to pick a source log. Now, technically, we replicate volumes. Storage replica works at the volume level. But clusters don't know or care about volumes. They care about disks. So when you're doing stretch cluster, the semantics are at the disk layer, not at the volume layer. When you do your own replication, if you configure it with, say, PowerShell, if you were to do server to server, for example, you can go as granular as the volume itself, or mount point, or drive letter, whatever you want. So I'm going to select this source log disk. And of course, it's only showing me the ones that are eligible. So if it's not a GPT disk, if it doesn't have enough space, if it doesn't have a file system on it whatsoever, those simply won't show up here. And I'm going to pick. So I started with this volume down here, which was D. I'm going to pick the same letter. It doesn't really matter because cluster is going to take care of this for us on the other side. You see all the ones that are eligible, they're, you know, the same size. They're formatted correctly. They have the right kinds of disk. And then I choose a destination log. Now, the log can contain logs for lots of different sets of replication. Right now, I'm setting up the very first one, so I'm using the only thing I have to choose from, right? And then this option here, which right now does absolutely nothing, but it looks great, is the ability to say, well, I've already put a lot of data on these volumes, and I have a ton of data. So rather than replicating all of it the first time, if I restored a backup, if I copied it, you know, took a split mirrored disk, if I mail it over there, it might be faster for me to actually mail, you know, 2 petabytes of storage and then replicate the 1 gigabyte that changed while I actually mailed stuff. And then there's the usual, are you sure? I'm always sure. And it's setting up replication right now. Now, you can see in the background, storage is sort of flipping around and being reassigned to the pieces. You're seeing, you see throughout this, the term WVR, that is the old code name of this product. So whenever you see Windows Volume Replication or WVR, just think storage replica. And the next copy you get, I promise, does not say WVR anymore. That was it. I'm done. So I'm now using storage replication. It's configured. And if I go and look, and this is where you close your eyes. Close your eyes. Okay. That's just a bug. It's okay. That's the one time you have to do that. It'll work forever after this, I promise.
Tomorrow, what can you show in your demo?
So I'm not done yet, because what I'll show right now is actually failing stuff over. What I'll show you tomorrow is I'll show you server to server. I'll show you PowerShell. I'll show you hilarious antics. But right now, as you can see, this replication role column, which never existed before now, is filled in with sources and destinations. And there's a tab down here that you've never seen before that's with the relationships. And you can see the status is filled in with don't know, because that part isn't done in this build. So it's always unknown. You know, this is the beauty of doing these early previews. You get all this lovely unfinished code to look at. If you want to know if it's actually done, just go take a look at the event log. 5009 says it's done. If you remember nothing else out of this, 5009 says it's done. And what I can do now is I can just put some data on here and prove that this thing actually works. So let's go back to my server 1, imaginatively named. And on its D drive, I'll tell you what we'll do. Have you guys seen this part of the command prompt? Does anybody show this at the keynote or anything? The experimental tab? Oh, man, it's awesome. So awesome. Like, it's hard to show. Like, I can't show you that I'm doing Control V, but I really am doing Control V in here. It's crazy. So if I go here to Windows, and I just, you know, just copy some goo. Okay, some files went over there. That's fine. And just to prove that I'm not doing any smoke and mirrors, I will create a file from scratch. And it's my canary file, which means that I have to have an actual canary right here. He's got little eyes. Just to prove there's nothing else going on here, there's no jokes. Okay? There's my canary file. It's on the D volume. Let's fail this over. Very simple to fail stuff over, just like as usual. Move some other node in the other site. Pending, pending, pending. If you want to see actual, like, you know, activity and fun stuff going on, you can go watch the disks flipping around and flopping and doing things. Oh, I missed it. It's over too fast, sorry. And if we go over here to server 3, magically, you remember he didn't have a D drive just a second ago? Are you paying attention? Okay, he's got a D drive now. It's got files on it. There's my awesome canary drawing, so this thing really does work. And that's all I'm going to show you today. Come see all the rest at 5 tomorrow, okay?
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks.
All right. So let's do a quick time check.
Yep.
I think we're doing good on time. Again, if you have any questions, you know, feel free to ask. Come to the front of this room here, or you know, we'll reserve a batch at the end. So that was Netpile. So we showed you all the technologies that are available in Windows Server Preview, which is the build we announced back in September. So what's next beyond Windows Server Technical Preview? I just want to give you guys a sneak peek into some of the things we're doing beyond that. So let me kind of first start with storage spaces, shared nothing. So what this means in summary is essentially, if you recall, when I showed you storage spaces today, behind the scale-out file server, if you have like two nodes I showed you, and that's connected to shared JBOD, right? That needs a SAS fabric. It has a shared JBOD. You need SAS. You know, both your nodes are connected to that JBOD storage through SAS, okay? And that's basically what we call shared storage with storage spaces today. And that's available in Windows Server 2012 R2. A lot of our customers told us, hey, what if I don't need that JBOD connected to both the nodes or four nodes? What if I need to just use the storage inside the server? Or maybe I can attach a JBOD, but only seen by that server. So we kind of took that, and essentially we have something, you know, we call spaces, storage spaces shared nothing. So essentially what it lets you do is use the capacity in each of your scale-out file server nodes. You know, this could be internal to the scale-out file server, or it could be a JBOD hanging behind the file server. But the key point is only that server owns that storage. Nobody else does. That's why it's called shared nothing. And what we are doing is essentially, you know, we have a bunch of those servers, and as you need more capacity, you keep adding servers. So why is this interesting, right? So one of the first thing was, this is the cloud design, because essentially this is how also typically if you look at Azure, Google, based on their public paper, everybody uses, you know, shared nothing storage, essentially, okay? So one of the key things is it lets you reduce hardware cost. Why does it let you reduce hardware cost? You know, one key thing. It lets you get rid of your SAS cabling in the back, basically, okay? And it lets you use SATA drives. I'll talk a little bit about that. Essentially, what it's doing is, today, you can use only SAS, and with SATA, especially for SSDs, the price point is pretty, pretty critical, okay, compared to, if you compare SATA and SAS SSDs, SATA SSDs are typically much cheaper. So it lets you use SATA HDDs and SATA SSDs. So that's kind of one thing. It's a cabling cost and SATA drives. It lets you, basically, the other benefits is around finer-grained scaling, okay? You can add capacity and performance in terms of single node increments, okay? You can add one node at a time and keep growing your scale-out file server cluster, okay? You can scale the pools to large number of drives, okay? You can go to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of disks, okay? Right now, we are thinking about like a 12-node endpoint, for example, with hundreds of disks. And then, I mean, basically, you have really good fine-grained storage expansion, not just capacity, but also performance, okay? What are the use cases? We recommend this for primary IaaS workloads. For example, you know, your primary IaaS workloads, you know, running inside virtual machines, SQL or SQL or SharePoint, and also as a backup and replication target, basically, so two modes. So this is something we are working on. Stay tuned. We will talk more about this in a few months, okay? One thing I do want to call out is prescriptive configuration. So I just want to set expectations that this is not going to be something we will recommend you to set up in the initial releases, because one of the key things we found out is this is not going to work with any server you buy from any shop and put it together for two reasons. First of all, when we are doing this end-to-end, there's a lot of componentry involved. I mean, if you think about your scale-out file server cluster talking to Hyper-V, it's talking to the HBAs on both ends, going to a storage fabric. There is a SAS expander involved in the middle. There's microcode of the drives. There's a lot of things which come into play. And believe me, in scale, we have seen a lot of issues. And this is not just us. Everybody in the industry, this is new, which we know how to kind of bound by having very prescriptive guidance, okay? So this will be delivered through our partners, basically. Something, you know, we are working with our partners. We'll work with them closely. It'll be on very prescribed configuration so that we do a lot of the integration and, you know, the bundling of the complete hardware and software so that you don't have to put this together yourself and discover things as they go wrong. We will take care of a lot of that for you. So this is something I just want to give you a quick sneak peek. That was one. Some of you may ask is, hey, you're still showing two separate clusters, Hyper-V and scale-out file server clusters. Okay? Why do I need two separate clusters? Architecturally, you don't. I mean, we could technically collapse this, collapse the Hyper-V cluster and the storage cluster onto the same node. We don't recommend that at this point of time because we believe as you scale higher, there is benefits of separating storage and compute. Okay? For the simple reason that you want to scale compute and storage independently of each other. Okay? So typically, there's a lot of buzz in the industry around, you know, what they call hyperconverged. This supports hyperconverged, but in the V1 version of the product, you will not see hyperconverged architectures. We believe hyperconverged makes sense if there's a smaller design point for a remote office, branch office, where there is a lot of small nodes. But as you grow for a large-scale environment, it is going to be disaggregated. So with that, let me just switch to another scenario. This is, again, we talked about VM compute resiliency. This is about VM storage resiliency. So typically today, and this is not new, I mean, this is something we have not done well. I mean, if a VM has no path to the storage, okay, we assumed in the past when there was, you know, expensive, highly reliable SAN arrays, the VM always had path to the storage, and the storage multipathing software in the SAN would take care of any outages. But often what happens is when the VM loses all path to the storage today, we are not graceful about how that VM behaves. Okay, the VM goes in a pretty erratic state. It is not graceful. It kind of thrashes and churns, basically. I mean, that's not a good outcome. So what we want to do, if the VM has no path to the storage for whatever reason, backend, we want to be graceful about pausing that VM, you know, checkpointing it. And when the storage path comes back, you want to play that, all those IOs back. I mean, do essentially a SCSI playback. And kind of, so the benefit to you is we are really being, you know, graceful about storage path failures, like we are being graceful about compute failures and node failures in the other deck, okay? So this is something we are going to be working on. You'll stay tuned. You're going to see more about this, okay? So that's the animation, basically. Sorry. So I talked a lot about software scenarios, okay? And one of the key learnings that we had from the cloud platform system is it is not just software. It is ultimately about end-to-end solutions. And not just end-to-end solutions, but making sure we deliver end-to-end solutions that are vetted at cloud scale, at cloud availability, performance, okay? So we were really mindful of that. And let me just kind of walk you through. For some of you who went to the CPS session, you already saw this today. But let me kind of talk. This is the proof point on the cloud platform solution and using our stack. This is not the vNext stack. This is the 2012 R2 stack that has storage, compute, and network. So if you see the storage basically here, the storage has what we call a 4x4. It has four scale-out file server nodes with four JBODs in the back end, okay? And each of these scale units in one rack essentially is giving you 282 terabytes of capacity, and you can scale this to four racks, okay? So why is this interesting? Because when we have tested the solution from one rack to four racks, this has first of all been collectively tested across Microsoft, not just inside Microsoft. We have worked with our partners. Remember I told you how things matter? I mean, you know, firmware of the hard drives, firmware of the host bus adapters, firmwares of the RDMA NICs. Things matter when they come end-to-end, okay? So we have done a lot of this integration and heavy lifting for you, okay? And this, what we call the CPS storage scale unit, is going to be available to you as, you know, as customers. Stay tuned for that. So basically, we recommend, you know, there's a lot of ask about when I deploy Spaces and scale out file server, what is the guidance and the configuration I should start with? I would recommend start with this 4x4 configuration for your needs. And that's something, you know, stay to the componentry, and that's basically what you're going to, you know, that's the configuration which is going to be tested and vetted at scale by Microsoft internally. Of course, you could have deviation from that config based on your needs, but that's something, you know, we are working with our partners like Dell, like DataON, Rading, Supermicro, you know, to make sure that the configuration which is shipped to you as customers is essentially vetted and tested at the, as endpoints, okay? So with that, let me just kind of talk about when we test that. In the CPS talk, we talked about 1 year in 7 days, okay? And you're going to see this 1 year in 7 days. So let me just talk a little bit about what that means. So we were really diligent about making sure that we really emulate 1 year's of failures, okay? And when I say failures, we have different fault domain failures, you know, including power outage of the JBODs, disks going down in entire shelves, switches going down. I mean, our test team was really, really, you know, adamant and doing the right thing on doing what we call JBOD pulls, network cable pulls, NIC pulls across the board. So really, you know, we wanted to make sure that we really have, you know, a lot of this cloud learnings in terms of reliability, in terms of scale, and inject a lot of failures in the stack, essentially, making sure that when we are doing this, you know, it is really, really resilient and available at scale. Now, when we run workloads, what we are running inside those VMs are first-party workloads. And that is done with two things, end-to-end and at scale. Because when I say end-to-end, this is running with your, you know, WAP, system center, the storage stack, network stack, compute stack all together. And also, basically, it is running, you know, with making sure that, you know, when you are running SQL or Exchange and SharePoint, it is emulating real-life conditions, okay, in terms of regular backup windows and things like that. So we are very much real, and this has been a lot of good learnings for us, which we are feeding back into Windows Server, which is all goodness. So with that, I'm going to basically, we have 12 minutes left, I'm going to wrap this up with one slide, which talks about, you know, so that you know, you have a storage choice. You know, we have a great story with our partners in terms of SANs, Nice Cousin Fiber Channel SAN, that continues. We embrace that. We will always interop with that. We will always test that, making sure you have a supported story. But we also have a great story coming up with our software-defined storage stack with SMB3 and scale-out file server with storage spaces. Today, with shared SAS JBOD, or in the future, what we call with shared nothing, okay? And if you see the value prop, it is pretty compelling in terms of what you get in-box in Windows Server with an integrated solution with our partners. So I think the meta point here is, you know, I urge you to go back, take a look at your storage solutions. This is a good opportunity for you to consider 2012 R2 in its current form, and of course, you know, Windows Server vNext when it comes out. So with that, I'm going to, you know, stop here and talk a little bit about some of the sessions. We have some great sessions tomorrow around storage performance, quality of service, Patrick Lang, and we also have replication as well, and also storage management and designing the scale-out file server basically tomorrow as well. And you can see me at the storage booth. And I'm going to pause here 11 minutes and open it up to questions. Any questions? Come on. Thank you. I'll repeat the question. Are there any plans to integrate the FC target in the next version of Windows Server? Right now, there is no plan, but we would be happy to chat. If you have any, you know, scenarios or business case where you basically need that, we're happy to chat on that. Yeah. Any other? Yeah. Go ahead. Are there any performance considerations for this, for the log disk? Yes, there is. I'll let Ned. You can use the mic there.
Can you hear me? So the question is, are there performance considerations for storage replicas log disk? Yes. That is the right I/O path now for your application. So you want it to be SSD, flash, something fast, because you are now saying for every time I write to the disk that I want to write to, I have to pass through somebody else's disk and over the network and his disk and back over the network. So everything you do to minimize latency will be faster. And obviously it will never, there's interesting things that happen when you use storage replica, like we create something called write aggregation, which doesn't exist in Windows. So certain kinds of writes that you do, random writes, that show up in interesting patterns, we can actually be faster than writing to the disk directly, because we are taking a bunch of IOs and sending them around and writing them ourselves the way that the OS doesn't do yet by itself. But generally speaking, we're going to make you slower. Maybe just a little bit, maybe a lot. It depends on you and your workload. And we'll talk about that more a lot tomorrow.
And we're also doing, just to add to that, we'll have a lot of best practices guidance. And we're also doing an early validation tool to make sure before you set things up, it gives you a sense of what you need on the other side in terms of your validation.
We will give you as much help as we possibly can for this, because it's complicated.
Yeah. All right. Other questions, please? What about deduplication? Yeah, so I didn't talk about dedupe. We are doing a couple of things in dedupe which are showing up in R2 first. So if you heard the talk on CPS, we are doing two things in dedupe, making sure dedupe works well with a backup target. Okay, this could be DPM or any backup. And really working that, making sure when we are taking backups at scale with a large number of VMs, we are really making sure that operates well at scale. So we have done some parallel optimizations and what I call some VSS provider enhancements, if you will, in DPM to make sure that it works, and dedupe works well with that in terms of it's highly, highly parallelized. I urge you to go to the DPM session if you want to see the DPM side of the story. And then dedupe, we don't have a session, but I'm happy to kind of take questions offline and take it back to the dedupe team. But think about it. I mean, the first use case of dedupe is going to be we see as backup, basically. I mean, dedupe on backup targets. The only key primary use case we see for dedupe is also VDI. But that's also a trade-off. I mean, when you turn on dedupe, there is going to be a little bit of trade-off, and that's something we recommend. Go on a case-by-case basis, see what your needs are. And really, it's a trade-off on performance and data optimization. Other questions? There's one question here.
Nothing. The low-cost solution.
Yes.
How do you get the data consistent over all the disks, which are separated, which are isolated, I think?
Yeah. So I didn't talk a whole lot about that. So if you think about it, we have something called a storage bus layer, which makes sure that when we, essentially, the storage bus layer is basically works over SMB. It acts as your storage fabric, where your upper layers are seeing all the disks, essentially, okay? And what this does is, this is not a new architecture, it works with spaces tiering. It works with spaces parity. It kind of sits beneath spaces, except that the deployment mode is new, okay? So we have been very cognizant that when we do this, shared nothing mode, it really, slips into our existing spaces deployment and all the stack that we are building. I mean, with tiering working fine, with basically all the benefits of spaces that you have today, we carry forward into this deployment mode. But the key thing is the storage bus layer, which essentially uses SMB as a transport, and that's used to replicate and talk to data across disk and to make all the disk visible. And what it does is really it's taking the SATA fabric today and really expanding it. SATA has limitations. SATA drives through a SAS fabric has limitations of distance, right? And through cabling, you can see up to like 4 nodes only. So this is really taking SAS fabric and really extending it using SMB, where it can go to any number of nodes at very large scale. Initially, we are thinking about 12, but architecturally, there is no limitation on going beyond that. Other, yeah.
I just want to do a little correction. There's actually a dedupe talk on Friday, and we will go into details of how dedupe and DTM, DPM will be integrated.
There you go. So he's from the dedupe team, and we're going to have a talk on, you know, dedupe basically on Friday. Okay, great. I missed that. Yeah.
Is there now at the moment, or in the future, going to be a cost for the Cloud Witness?
Cloud Witness is shipping in Windows Server Technical Preview. It already ships today. Yeah, it is available. Is that your question?
No, is there going to be a cost for it?
Oh, cost, yeah. I mean, the cost is going to be to subscribe to an Azure storage account. That's your cost. I mean, that's something you got to pay. But that cost, I think, will be pretty minimal compared to setting up a third site with either a Loon witness or a FileShare witness, I would think.
The size of the data in the liquid storm is very tiny.
And the
tiny. So when we were doing testing, it was, I think at first when they tested, they couldn't actually get it to be charged that little.
Yeah, I remember the story. This is really a true story.
We don't know yet.
On the credit card charge for the department, it's a few cents. Okay, so
like being charged,
I'm telling
a penny.
You, it's not going to be a whole lot of cost there. So you don't need to worry about cost.
Yeah.
Trust me. Other questions? Yeah, there's one more question here.
Does storage spaces use anything for preventing data corruption? I saw ReFS mentioned there. Does it use that under the covers? Or?
Yeah, so basically ReFS and spaces are two different technologies, but they work together, okay? So ReFS, as you know, has basically capability of bit rot detection. It has what we call data integrity and metadata integrity. But it needs a reliable storage underneath and to tell the reliable storage to correct it. So what you see in the stack could basically, you know, we are thinking about working that with ReFS. So if you have bitrot corruptions and it's able to kind of signal to spaces and kind of get that fixed under the covers. So the answer, short answer to the question is yes. Other questions? The one in the back? Sorry, just.
Have you tested SQL clustering on top of this?
Can you repeat the question?
SQL clustering.
Yes.
You've tested it.
Yeah, SQL clustering. So let me tell about SQL clustering. Yes, the answer is yes. SQL clustering, absolutely yes. The question I've also gotten, you know, when do I use SQL Always On and this product? Okay, that's the other question. So first, SQL clustering is absolutely tested. What we are recommending this for is for virtualized private cloud environments where you're running SQL virtualized. So if you have SQL bare metal or you have a complete SQL farm, which is truly SQL, we recommend you use Always On. Okay, where storage replica comes very handy is if you have multiple types of tenants with what I call mixed workloads, somebody running SharePoint, somebody has Exchange, somebody you don't even know what they're running inside the guest. Okay, it could be a line of business app. And they're all virtualized. So you have different, and some of them don't have replication built-in. So this is where you could get all of your tenant VMs, synchronous replication underneath on a common fabric. And then there is Hyper-V replica, remember, which lets you do VM-based replication on a per VM basis or small number of VMs. This is really being able to scale that to a large number of VMs because it does it at the raw volume level, okay? And this works, again, with any storage backend. We don't care. Any other questions? All right, so with that, again, thank you for your time and have a great decade.